Chapter 6. A Stave and a Razor. Matt had never really expected Luca to leave Jurador after only one day. The stone-walled salt town was wealthy, and Luca did like to see coin stick to his hands. So he was not exactly disappointed when the man told him that Valenluca's grand traveling show and magnificent display of marvels and wonders would remain there at least two more days. Not exactly disappointed, yet he had hoped that his luck might hold good or his being Taviran. But then, being Taviran had never brought anything other than bad that he could see.
"The lines at the entrance are already as long as they were at their best yesterday," Luca said, gesturing expansively.
They were inside Luca's huge, gaudy wagon early on the morning after Rena's death, and the tall man sat in the gilded chair at the narrow table, a real table with stools tucked under for guests. Most other wagons had an affair rigged on ropes from the ceiling, and people sat on the beds to eat. Luca had not yet donned one of his flamboyant coats, but he made up for it with gestures. Littell, his wife, was cooking the breakfast porridge on a small iron-topped brick stove built into a corner of the windowless wagon, and the air was sharp with spices. The harsh-faced woman put so many spices into everything she prepared that it was all inedible in Matt's estimation, yet Luca always gobbled down whatever she set in front of him, as if it were a feast. He must have a leather tongue.
"I expect twice as many visitors today, maybe three times as many, and tomorrow as well. People can't see everything in one visit, and here they can afford to come twice. Word of mouth, Cawthon, word of mouth. That brings as many as Aludra's night flowers.
I feel almost like Taviran, the way things are falling out. Large audiences and the prospect of more, a warrant of protection from the High Lady."
Luca cut off abruptly, looking faintly embarrassed as if he had just remembered that Matt's name was on that warrant as being excluded from protection.
"You might not like it if you really were Taviran," Matt muttered, which made the other man give him an odd look. He put a finger behind the black silk scarf that hid his hanging scar and tugged at it. For a moment, the thing had felt too tight. He had spent a night of bleak dreams about corpses floating downstream and woken to the dice spinning in his head, always a bad sign, and now they seemed to be bouncing off the inside of his skull harder than before.
"I can pay you as much as you'll make for every show you give between here and Lugard, no matter how many people attend. That's on top of what I promised for carrying us to Lugard."
If the show was not stopping all the time, they could cut the time to reach Lugard by three quarters at the least. More if he could convince Luca to spend whole days on the road instead of half days the way they did now. Luca seemed taken with the idea, nodding thoughtfully, but then he shook his head with a sadness that was plainly feigned and spread his hands.
"And what will that look like? A traveling show that never stops to give shows? It will look suspicious, that's what. I have the warrant, and the High Lady will speak up for me besides. But you certainly don't want to pull the Shonchan down on us. No, it's safer for us this way."
The man was not thinking of Matt Cawthon's bloody safety. He was thinking that his bloody shows might earn him more than Matt paid. That, plus making himself as much the center of attention as any of the performers, was nearly as important to him as gold. Some of the show folk talked of what they would do when they retired. Not Luca. He intended to keep on until he fell over dead in the middle of a show, and he would arrange it so he had the largest audience possible when he did.
"It's ready, Valen,"
Littell said affectionately as she lifted the iron pot from the stove with a cloth protecting her hands and set it down on a thick woven mat on the table. Two places had already been set, with white glazed plates and silver spoons. Luca would have silver spoons when everyone else settled for tin or pot metal or even horn or wood. Stern-eyed, with a hard set to her mouth, the bear trainer looked quite odd wearing a long white apron over her spangled blue dress. Her bears probably wished they had trees to climb when she frowned at them. Strangely, though, she jumped to ensure her husband's comforts.
"Will you be eating with us, Master Cawthon?"
There was no welcome in that. In fact, just the opposite, and she showed no sign of turning to the cupboard where the plates were stored. Matt gave her a bow that soured her face further. He had never been less than civil to the woman, but she refused to like him.
"I thank you for the kind invitation, Mistress Luca, but no."
She grunted. So much for being courteous. He put on his flat-brimmed hat and left, the dice rattling away. Luca's big wagon, glittering in red and blue and covered with golden stars and comets, not to mention the phases of the moon in silver, stood in the middle of the show, as far as possible from the animals' smelly cages and the horse lines. It was surrounded by smaller wagons, little houses on wheels, most windowless and most painted just a single color with none of Luca's extra decorations, and by wall tents, the size of small houses in blue or green or red, sometimes striped. The sun stood nearly its own height above the horizon in a sky where a sprinkling of white clouds drifted slowly, and children ran playing with hoops and balls, while the show folk were limbering up for their morning performances, men and women twisting and stretching, many with glittering, colorful spangles on their coats or dresses. Four contortionists, in filmy trousers tied at the ankle and blouses thin enough to leave little to the imagination, made him wince. Two were sitting on their own heads atop blankets spread on the ground beside their red tent, while the others had twisted themselves into a pair of knots that looked beyond untying. Their backbones must have been made of spring wire. Petra, the strong man, stood bare-chested beside the green wagon he shared with his wife, warming up by lifting weights with either hand that Matt was not sure he could have lifted with both. The man had arms thicker than Matt's legs, and he was not sweating at all. Clarine's dogs stood in a line at the steps of the wagon, wagging their tails and eagerly waiting on their trainer. Unlike Littell's bears, Matt figured the plump woman's dogs performed so they could make her smile. He was always tempted to just sit quietly somewhere when the dice were clicking in his head, someplace nothing seemed likely to happen, waiting for the dice to stop, and though he would have enjoyed watching some of the female acrobats, a number of whom were as little as the contortionists, he set out to walk the half-mile to Jurador, eyeing everyone on the wide, hard-packed clay road closely. There was a purchase he hoped to make. People were coming to join the long line, waiting behind a stout rope, stretched along the show's tall canvas wall, only a handful with more than a touch of embroidery on the women's dresses or the men's short coats, and a few farmers' high-wheeled carts lumbering behind a horse or an ox. Figures moved among the small forest of windmills that pumped the salt wells in the low hills behind the town, and around the long evaporation pans. A merchant's train of canvas-covered wagons, 20 of them behind 6-horse teams, rumbled out of the town gates as he approached, the merchant herself in a bright green cloak seated beside the driver of the first wagon. A flock of crows cawed past overhead, giving him a chill, but no one vanished before his eyes, and everybody cast a long shadow so far as he could make out. There were no dead people's shades walking the road today, although he was convinced that was what he had seen the day before. The dead walking surely could mean nothing good. Very likely it had something to do with Tarmengaiden and Rand. Colors whirled in his brain, and for an instant in his head, he saw Rand and Min standing beside a large bed, kissing. He stumbled and nearly tripped over his own boots. They had not been wearing any clothes. He would have to be careful thinking about Rand. The colors swirled and resolved for a moment, and he stumbled again. There were worse things to spy on than kissing. Very careful, what he thought. Light. The pair of guards leaning on their halberds at the iron-studded gates, hard-faced men in white breastplates and conical white helmets, with horsetail crests, eyed him suspiciously. They probably thought he was drunk. A reassuring nod failed to change their expressions by a hair. He could have used a stiff drink right then. The guards did not try to stop him entering, though, just watched him pass. Drunks caused trouble, especially a man who was drunk this early in the day. But a drunk in a good coat, plain but well-cut and good silk, a man with a little lace at his wrists, was an altogether different matter. The stone-paved streets of Jurador were noisy even at this hour, with hawkers carrying trays or standing behind barrows crying their wares, and shopkeepers beside narrow tables in front of their shops bellowing the fineness of their goods, and coopers hammering hoops onto barrels for shipping salt. The clatter of rugmakers' looms nearly drowned out the ringing of the occasional blacksmith's hammer, not to mention the music of flutes and drums and dulcimers drifting from inns and taverns. It was a jumble of a town with shops and houses and inns, cheek by jowl with taverns and stables, all of stone and roofed with reddish tiles. A solid town, Jurador, and one accustomed to thievery. Most windows on the lower floors were covered with stout screens of wrought iron. The upper windows as well on the homes of the wealthy, most of whom were no doubt salt merchants. The music of the inns and taverns pulled at him. Likely there would be dice games going on in most of them. He could almost feel those dice spinning across a table. It had been too long since he had rattled a set of dice in his hands instead of inside his head, but he was not there for gambling this morning. He had had no breakfast yet, so he approached a wrinkled woman with a tray hung from a strap around her neck who shouted, "Meat pies made from the finest beef to be found in Altara." He took her word for it and handed over the coppers she demanded. He had seen no cattle at any farms near Jurador, only sheep and goats, but it was best not to inquire too closely what was in a pie bought in the streets of any town. There could be cows on nearby farms. There could be. In any case, the meat pie was tasty and still hot for a wonder, and he walked on along the crowded street, juggling the pie and wiping greasy juice from his chin. He was careful not to bump into anyone in the throng. Altarans were a touchy lot, by and large. In this town, you could tell somebody's station to within a whisker by the amount of embroidery on coat or dress or cloak, the more the higher, long before you were close enough to tell wool from silk. Though the richer women covered their olive-skinned faces with transparent veils hung from ornate combs stuck into their tightly coiled braids. But men and women alike, whether salt merchants or ribbon hawkers, wore long belt knives with curved blades and sometimes fondled the hilts as though looking for a fight. He always tried to avoid fighting, though his luck seldom did him much good there. Taviran took over with that, it seemed. The dice had never before signaled a fight. Battles, yes, but never a dust-up in the street. Yet he walked very carefully indeed. Not that that would help, of course. When the dice stopped, they stopped, and that was that. But he saw no reason to take chances. He hated taking chances. Except with gambling, of course, and that was hardly taking a chance for him. He spotted a barrel full of thick quarterstaffs and walking staffs in front of a shop displaying swords and daggers under the watchful eye of a bulky fellow with sunken knuckles, a nose that had been broken more than once, and a thick truncheon hanging at his belt beside the inevitable dagger. The man announced in a rough voice that all the blades on display were Andoran-made, but anybody who did not make his own blades always claimed they were Andoran, or else from the Borderlands. Or Tyran, sometimes. Tyr made good steel. To Matt's surprise and delight, Slim's stave of what appeared to be black yew, more than a foot taller than he was, stood upright in the barrel. Pulling the stave out, he checked the fine, almost braided grain. It was black yew, all right. That braided grain was what gave bows made from it such power. Twice what any other wood could give. You could never be sure until you started slicing away the excess, but the stave looked perfect. How in the light had black yew come to be in southern Altara? He was sure it only grew in the two rivers. When the proprietor came out, a sleek woman with bright-feathered birds embroidered to below her bosom, and began extolling the virtues of her blades, he said, "How much for this black stick, mistress?" She blinked, startled that a man in silken lace wanted a quarterstaff. Slim as it was, she thought the thing was a bloody quarterstaff, and named a price that he paid without bargaining, which made her blink again and frown as if she thought she should have asked more. He would have paid more for the makings of a Two Rivers bow. With the raw bow stave over his shoulder, he walked on, wolfing down the last of the meat pie and wiping his hand on his coat. But he had not come for breakfast or a bow stave any more than for gambling. It was the stables that interested him. Livery stables always had a horse or three for sale, and if the price was right, they would usually sell one that had not been for sale. At least they did when the Seanchan had not snapped them up already. Luckily, the Seanchan presence in Jurador had been fleeting so far. He wandered from stable to stable, examining bays and roans, blue roans and piebalds, duns, sorrels, blacks, whites, grays, and dapples, all mares or geldings. A stallion would not serve his purposes. Not every animal he looked at had a shallow girth or long cannons, yet none matched what he had in mind. Until he entered a narrow stable jammed between a large stone inn called the 12 Salt Wells and a rug maker's shop. He would have thought the racketing looms would have bothered the horses, but they were all quiet, apparently accustomed to the noise. stalls stretched farther into the block than he had expected. But lanterns hanging from the stall posts gave a fair light away from the doors. The air, speckled with dust from the loft above, smelled of hay and oats and horse dung, but not old dung. Three men with shovels were mucking out stalls. The owner kept his place clean. That meant less chance of disease. Some stables he had walked out of after getting one whiff. The black and white mare was out of her stall on a rope halter while a groom put down fresh straw, and she stood squarely, and with her ears perked forward, showing alertness. About 15 hands tall, she was long in front, with a deep girth that promised endurance, and her legs were perfectly proportioned with short cannons and a good angle to her fetlocks. Her shoulders were well sloped, and her croup dead level with her withers. She had lines as good as Pip's, or even better. More than that, she was a breed he had heard tell of but never thought to see, a razor from Ardoman. No other breed would have that distinctive coloring. In her coat, black met white in straight lines that could have been sliced by a razor, hence the name. Her presence here was as mystifying as the black ewe. He had always heard Nodemani would sell a razor to any outlander. He let his eyes sweep past her without lingering, studying the other animals in their stalls. Had the dice inside his head slowed? No, it was his imagination. He was sure they were spinning as hard as they had in Luca's wagon. A wiry man with only a fringe of gray hair remaining came forward, ducking his head over folded hands.
"Toke Fearnum, my lord,"
he introduced himself in rough accents, eyeing the bowstave on Matt's shoulder dubiously. Men who wore silk coats and gold signet rings rarely carried such things.
"How can I be of service? My lord wishes to rent a horse or to buy?"
Embroidery, small bright flowers, covered the shoulders of the vest he wore over a shirt that might have been white once. Matt avoided looking at the flowers at all. The fellow had one of those curved knives at his belt and two long white scars on his leathery face. Old scars. Any fighting he had done lately had not marked him where it showed.
"Bye, Master Fearnum, if you have anything for sale. If I can find one that's halfway decent. I've had more spavined glue-baits offered to me as 6-year-olds when they were 18, if a day, than I can shake a stick at."
He hefted the bowstave slightly with a grin. His disclaimed bargaining went better if you could make the other fellow start grinning.
"I have 3 for sale, my lord. None of them spavined," the wiry man replied with another bow and no hint of a grin.
Fearnum gestured.
"One is out of her stall there, 5 years old and prime horse flesh, my lord, and a steel at 10 crowns. Gold," he added blandly.
Matt let his jaw drop.
"For a piebald? I know the Seanchan have driven prices up, but that's ridiculous." "Oh, she's not your common piebald, my lord. A razor is what she is. Domani Bloodborne ride razors."
Blood and bloody ashes. So much for catching a bargain.
"So you say, so you say," Matt muttered, lowering one end of the bowstave to the stone floor so he could lean on it.
His hip seldom bothered him any longer, except when he did a lot of walking, but he had done so this morning, and he felt twinges. Well, bargain or no, he had to play out the game. There were rules to horse trading. Break them, and you are asking to have your purse emptied out.
"I've never heard of any horse called a razor myself. What else do you have?" "Only geldings or mares, mind." "Geldings are all I have for sale except the razor, my lord,"
Fearnum said, emphasizing the word razor a little. Turning toward the back of the stable, he shouted,
"Adela, bring out that big bay what's for sale."
A lanky young woman with a pimply face, in breeches and a plain dark vest, came darting out of the back of the stable to obey. Fearnum had Adela walk the bay, and then a dappled gray on rope leads in the good light near the doors.
Matt had to hand him that. Their confirmation was not bad at all.
But the bay was too big, better than 17 hands, and the gray kept his ears half laid back and tried to bite Adela's hand twice. She was deft with the animals, though, easily evading the bad-tempered gray's lunges. Rejecting the pair of them would have been easy if he had not had his mind set on the razor.
A lean, gray-striped tomcat, like a ridge cat in miniature, appeared and sat at Virnum's feet to lick a bloody gash on his shoulder.
"Rats are worse this year than I ever recall," the stable-keeper muttered, frowning down at the cat. "They fight back more, too. I'm going to have to get another cat, or maybe two."
He brought himself back to the business at hand.
"Will my lord take a look at my prize, since the others don't suit?"
"I suppose I could look at the piebald, Master Fearnum," Matt said doubtfully, "but not for any 10 crowns.
"In gold," Fearnum said.
"Herd, walk the razor for the lord here."
He emphasized the breed again. Working the man down would be difficult, unless he got some help for a change from being Taviran. His luck never helped with anything as straightforward as dickering.
Hurd was the fellow refreshing the straw in the razor's stall, a squat man who had about 3 white hairs left on his head and no teeth in his mouth at all. That was evident when he grinned, which he did while he led the mare in a circle. He clearly liked the animal, and well he should. She walked well, but Matt still inspected her closely. Her teeth, said Fearnum, had been honest enough about her age. Only a fool lied very far about a horse's age unless the buyer was a fool himself, though it was surprising how many sellers thought buyers were all just that. And her ears pricked toward him when he stroked her nose while checking her eyes. They were clear and bright, free of rheum. He felt along her legs without finding any heat or swelling. There was never a hint of a lesion or sore, or of ringworm anywhere on her. He could get his fist easily between her ribcage and her elbow. She would have a long stride, and was barely able to fit his flat hand between her last rib and the point of her hip. She would be hardy, unlikely to strain a tendon if run fast.
"My lord knows his horse flesh, I see."
"That I do, Master Fearnum. And 10 crowns gold is too much, especially for a piebald. Some say they're bad luck, you know. Not that I believe it, not as such, or I wouldn't offer at all."
"Bad luck? I never heard that, my lord. What do you offer?"
"I could get Tyran bloodstock for 10 crowns gold. Not the best, true, but still Tyran.
I'll give you 10 crowns in silver."
Fearnum threw back his head, laughing uproariously, and when he stopped, they settled down to the dickering. In the end, Matt handed over 5 crowns in gold, along with 4 marks gold and 3 crowns silver, all stamped in Ebudar. There were coins from many countries in the chest under his bed, but foreign coin usually meant finding a banker or money changer to weigh them and work out what they were worth locally. Aside from attracting more notice than he wanted, he would have ended paying more for the animal, maybe even the full 10 crowns gold. Money changers' scales always seemed to work that way. He had not expected to get the man down that far, but from Fearnum's expression, grinning at last, he had never expected to receive so much. It was the best way for horse trading to end, with both sides thinking they had come out ahead. All in all, the day had begun very well, dice or no bloody dice. He should have known it would not last. When he got back to the show at midday, riding the razor bareback because of his aching hip and with the dice rattling in his head, the line of people was longer than when he had left, waiting to pass beneath the big blue banner stretched between 2 tall poles that carried the show's name in big red letters. As people dropped their coins into the clear glass pitcher, held by a heavy-set horse handler in a rough woolen coat, to be poured from there into an iron-bound chest under the watchful eyes of another horse handler, who was even larger, more people joined the line, so it never seemed to grow shorter. The thing stretched beyond the end of the rope and around the corner. For a small wonder, no one was pushing or shoving. There were obvious farmers in the line, wearing rough woolens and with dirt ingrained in their hands, though the children's faces, and those of the farm wives at least, had been scrubbed clean. Luca was getting his hoped-for crowd, unfortunately. No chance of convincing him to leave tomorrow now. The dice said something was going to happen, something fateful to Matt Bloody Cawthon, but what? There had been times when the dice stopped, and he still had no idea what happened. Just inside the canvas wall, with people streaming past to enjoy the performers lining both sides of the main street, Aludro was taking delivery of 2 wagon loads of barrels in various sizes. Of more than the barrels, it seemed. "I will show you where to park the wagons," the slender woman told the driver of the lead wagon, a lean man with a jutting jaw. Aludra's waist-long beaded braids swung as her eyes followed Matt for a moment, but she quickly turned back to the wagon driver.
"The horses you will take to the horse lines afterward, yes?"
Now what had she bought in such quantity?
Something for her fireworks, certainly. Every night, soon after dark, so she would catch everyone before they went to bed, she launched her night flowers, two or three for a town the size of Jurador, or if there were several villages close together. He had had some thoughts on why she wanted a bellfounder, but the only one that seemed to make any sense actually made no sense at all that he could see. He hid the mare on the horse lines. Well, you could not really hide a razor, but a horse was noticed less among horses, and the time was not right yet. The bowstave he left in the wagon he shared with Aginan and Doman, neither of whom was there, then headed for Tuon's faded purple wagon. That was parked not far from Luca's wagon now, though Matt wished it had been left near the storage wagons. Only Luca and his wife knew that Tuon was a high lady rather than a servant who had been about to expose Matt and Aginan to her supposed husband as lovers. But many among the show folk were already wondering why Matt spent more time with Tuon than with Aginan. Wondering and disapproving. They were an oddly prim lot for the most part, even the contortionists. Running off with the wife of a cruel lord was romantic. Canoodling with the lady's maid was sordid. Giving Tuon's wagon this favored spot, among the people who had been with Luca for years and were his most prized performers, was going to cause more talk. In truth, he hesitated about going to Tuon at all with the dice drumming in his head. They had stopped too often in her presence, and he still did not know the why for a single one of those times. Not for certain. Maybe the first time, it had just been meeting her. Thinking of it made the hair on the back of his neck want to stand up. Still, with women, you always had to take chances. With a woman like Tuon, 10 chances a day and never knowing the odds until it was too late. Sometimes he wondered why his luck failed to help him more with women. Women were certainly as unpredictable as any honest dice ever made. None of the Red Arms was on guard outside the wagon. They were beyond that now. So he trotted up the short flight of steps at the back of the wagon and rapped once before pulling the door open and entering. After all, he paid the rent for the thing, and they were hardly likely to be lying around unclothed at this time of day. Anyway, the door had a latch if they needed to keep people out. Mistress Annan was off somewhere, but the interior was still crowded. The narrow table had been let down on ropes from the ceiling, with mismatched plates of bread and olives and cheese laid out on it, along with one of Luca's tall silver wine pitchers, a squat red-striped pitcher, and flower-painted cups. Tuon, a month's growth of tightly curled black hair on her head, sat on the wagon's sole stool, at the far end of the table, with Seleucia sitting on one of the beds at her side, and Noel and Ulver on the other bed, elbows on the table. Today, Seleucia was in the dark blue Ebudare dress that displayed her memorable bosom so well, with a flowered scarf tied around her head, but Tuon wore a red dress that seemed to be made entirely of tiny pleats. Light had only bought her the silk yesterday. How had she convinced the show's seamstresses to complete a dress already? He was pretty certain that usually took longer than a day. With liberal promises of his gold, he suspected. Well, if you bought a woman's silk, you had to expect to pay to have it sewn. He had heard that saying as a boy, when he never expected to be able to afford silk, but it was the light's own truth.
"Only the women are ever seen outside their villages," Noel was saying, but the gnarled, white-haired old man cut off when Matt entered the wagon, pulling the door shut behind him. The scraps of lace at Noel's wrists had seen better days, as had his well-cut coat of fine gray wool, but both were clean and neat, though in truth they looked odd with his crooked fingers and battered face. Those belonged on an aging tavern tough, one who had gone on fighting long past his prime. Ulver, in the good blue coat Matt had made for him, grinned as widely as an ogier. Light he was a good boy, but he would never be handsome with those big ears and that wide mouth. His manner with women needed vast improvement if he was ever to have any luck there at all.
Matt had been trying to spend more time with Olver, to get him away from the influence of his uncles, Bannon and Harnon, and the other Red Arms, and the boy seemed to enjoy that. Just not as much as he enjoyed playing snakes and foxes or stones with Tuon and staring at Seleucia's bosom. It was all very well for those fellows to teach Olver how to shoot a bow and use a sword and the like, but if Matt ever learned who was teaching him to leer...
"Manners, toy,"
Tuon drawled, like honey sliding out of a dish. Hard honey. Around him, unless they were playing stones, her expression was usually severe enough for a judge handing down a death sentence, and her tone matched it.
"You knock, then wait for permission to enter. Unless you are property or a servant, then you do not knock. You also have grease on your coat. I expect you to keep yourself clean."
Olver's grin faded at hearing Matt admonished. Noel raked bent fingers through his long hair and sighed, then began studying the green plate in front of him as if he might find an emerald among the olives. Grim tone or no grim tone, Matt enjoyed looking at the dark little woman who was to be his wife, who was halfway his wife already. Light, all she had to do was say three sentences and the thing was done.
Burn him, but she was beautiful.
Once he had mistaken her for a child, but that had been because of her size, and her face had been obscured by a transparent veil. Without that veil, it was plain that that heart-shaped face belonged to a woman. Her big eyes were dark pools a man could spend a lifetime swimming in. Her rare smiles could be mysterious or mischievous, and he prized them. He enjoyed making her laugh, too, at least when she was not laughing at him. True, she was a little slimmer than he had always preferred, but if he could ever get an arm around her with that Seleucia there, he believed she would feel just right. And he might convince her to give him a few kisses with those full lips. Light, he dreamed about that sometimes. Never mind that she called him down as if they were really married. Well, almost never mind. Burn him if he could see what a little grease mattered. Lopin and Nerim, the two serving men he was saddled with, would fight over which one got to clean the coat. They had little enough to do that they really would if he did not name who received the task. He did not say that to her. Women like nothing better than making you defend yourself, and once you started, she had won. "I'll try to remember that, precious," he said with his best smile, sliding in beside Seleucia and putting his hat down on the other side from her. The blanket scrunched up between them, and they were a foot apart to boot, yet you would have thought he had pressed himself against her hip. Her eyes were blue, but the furious look she gave him was hot enough his coat should have been singed. "I hope there's more water than wine in that cup in front of Olver." "It's goat's milk," the boy said indignantly. Ah, well, maybe Olver was still a little too young even for well-watered wine. Tuon sat up very straight, though she was still shorter than Seleucia, who was a short woman herself.
"What did you call me?" she said, as close to crisply as her accent allowed.
"Precious. You have a pet name for me, so I thought I should have one for you, Precious." He thought Seleucia's eyes were going to pop right out of her head.
"I see," Tuon murmured, pursing her lips in thought.
The fingers of her right hand waggled as though idly, and Seleucia immediately slid off the bed and went to one of the cupboards. She still took time to glare at him over Tuon's head.
"Very well," Tuon said after a moment. "It will be interesting to see who wins this game, toy."
Matt's smile slipped. Game? He was just trying to regain a little balance. But she saw a game, and that meant he could lose. Was likely to, since he had no idea what the game was. Why did women always make things so complicated? Seleucia resumed her place and slid a chipped cup in front of him, and a blue-glazed plate that held half a loaf of crusty bread, six varieties of pickled olives mounded up, and three sorts of cheese. That perked his spirits again. He had hoped for this, if not expected it. Once you got a woman feeding you, she had a hard time finding it in herself to stop you from putting your feet under her table again.
"The thing of it is," Noel said, resuming his tale, "in those Iad villages you can see women of any age, but no men much above 20, if that. Not a one."
Olver's eyes grew even wider. The boy practically inhaled Noel's tales about the countries he had seen, even the lands beyond the Aiel Waste, swallowed them whole without butter.
"Are you any relation to Jane Charn, Noel?"
Matt chewed an olive and discreetly spat the pit into his palm. The thing tasted not far from spoiling. So did the next one. But he was hungry, so he gobbled them down and followed with some crumbly white goat cheese while ignoring the frowns Tuan directed at him. The old man's face went still as stone, and Matt had torn off a piece of bread and eaten that as well before Noel answered.
"A cousin," he said at last, grudgingly. "He was my cousin."
"You're related to Jane Farstrider?" Olver said excitedly. His favorite book was The Travels of Jane Farstrider, which he would have sat up reading by lamplight long past his bedtime had Julin and Thera allowed. He said he intended to see everything Farstrider had when he grew up, all that and more.
"Who is this man with two names?" Tuan asked. "Only great men are spoken of so, and you speak as if everyone should know him."
"He was a fool,"
Noel said grimly before Matt could open his mouth, though Olver did get his open and left it gaping while the old man continued.
"He went gallivanting about the world and left a good and loving wife to die of a fever without him there to hold her hand while she died. He let himself be made into a tool by—"
Abruptly, Noel's face went blank. Staring through Matt, he rubbed at his forehead as though attempting to recall something.
"Jane Farstrider was a great man," Olver said fiercely.
His hands curled into small fists, as though he was ready to fight for his hero.
"He fought Trollocs and Murdral, and he had more adventures than anyone else in the whole world, even Matt. He captured Cawen Germallan, after Germallan betrayed Malkir to the Shadow."
Noel came to himself with a start and patted Olver's shoulder.
"He did that, boy. That much is to his credit. But what adventure is worth leaving your wife to die alone?"
He sounded sad enough to die on the spot himself. Olver had no answer to that, and his face fell. If Noel had put the boy off his favorite book, Matt was going to have words with the old man. Reading was important. He read himself. Sometimes he did. And he made sure Olver had books he enjoyed. Standing, Tuan leaned across the table to rest a hand on Noel's arm. The stern look had vanished from her face, replaced by tenderness. A wide belt of dark yellow tooled leather cinched her waist, emphasizing her slim curves. More of his coin spent? Well, coin was always easy to come by for him, and if she did not spend it, likely he would throw it away on some other woman.
"You have a good heart, Master Charon."
She gave everybody their bloody names except for Matt Cawthon.
"Do I, my lady?"
Noel said, sounding as though he really wanted to hear an answer.
"Sometimes I think—"
Whatever he thought sometimes, they were not to learn it now. The door swung open, and Julin put his head into the wagon. The Tyran thief-catcher's conical red hat was at its usual jaunty angle, but his dark face was worried.
"Shanchan's soldiers are setting up across the road. I'm going to Thera. She'll take a fright if she hears it from anybody else."
And as quickly as that, he was gone again, leaving the door swinging.